From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the latest from Lansing as House and Senate Republicans try to undo some of the governor's line item vetoes. Plus, a former UAW official calls on the union's entire international board to resign.
We haven't even heard the last of whether there will be further indictments, whether there will be further raids, further investigations. But what is coming out loud and clear is that the UAW isn't apparently dealing with this itself.
And to look at direct primary health care.
So people need to know that this is not insurance, right? This is a direct payment between a consumer and a primary care physician.
So you pay a set monthly fee, but then you kind of get essentially almost unlimited access to your primary care physician. So you can text us, call us, video chat.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is movement today in Lansing to undo some of Governor Whitmer's 147 line item vetoes to the new state budget. Zach Gorchow from Gongwer News Service is with us now from Lansing. So, Zach, what is happening in the House and Senate today?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the legislative Republicans gearing up to respond to the line item vetoes that Governor Whitmer issued last week on a number of programs that they strongly support. And so what they're doing is they're introducing individual bills, one for each program that they want funding restored. And they're basically sort of setting the table in case negotiations or discussions with the governor don't go the way they would like, to send these bills to the governor's desk and basically force her to again veto funding for these programs, which are, for the most part, some of them are controversial, but many of them are sort of pretty popular on a bipartisan basis. But of course, the governor vetoed them last week because she felt the budget the Republicans put together was flawed, and this was a way to bring the Republicans back to the table.
So they're putting together we've heard of this term, supplemental budget bills today.
That's right. That's right. And usually a supplemental appropriations bill would be a hodgepodge. You know, there could be 30 different things that you could put virtually anything in a supplemental bill other than K-12 funding. That has to go into its own bill. But the idea here with doing them individually is to force individual votes on each one. And that affects legislative Democrats, too. You're going to be putting them in the position of, you know, they can't say, well, I support this program over here, but I don't support that one there, and that's why I voted no against the whole bill. By separating them out into each one, there's nowhere to hide. You got to vote yay or nay on each issue.
So how many supplemental budget bills are being stirred around today?
Well, so far, 23 bills have been introduced in the Senate. I expect to see some bills introduced in the House, too. What we don't know yet is if the House ones will be identical or if they're going to cover different issues entirely. We'll be finding that out pretty soon.
And do we know what programs Republicans are trying to restore funding for and what programs they are not seeking to restore funding for?
Well, so far, as far as what the Senate has introduced, some of the big ticket items would be the tuition grant program. That's a scholarship program based on need for students at private colleges and universities. The rural health care programs that have gotten a lot of attention. Something called secondary road patrols. That's aid to county sheriffs to do traffic patrols. The increase to charter schools that the governor vetoed. It's not the biggest chunk of money at $1 million, but it's certainly gotten a lot of attention.
Yeah.
The Autism Navigator program. These are some of the more notable ones that are part of these bills so far. And now what's not in it so far, a bill to the county jail reimbursement program, which counties rely on quite heavily to house inmates who otherwise would have gone to state prisons, is not in there. But as I said, maybe that shows up in one of the bills the House introduces. So we can't say for sure yet what hasn't been introduced.
And I got a sense from checking out Gongwer News Service that they are not planning on doing something with the programs the governor asked for in a supplemental.
Yeah, that's what they're saying right now, you know, that everybody has sort of retreated to their corners. And so the Republicans are not going to just go and say, okay, you win, Governor. We're going to put in the items you want to get the funding we want back. Basically, this is their way of saying, we don't like what you did. We're going to force, you know, your Democratic members to take a lot of really tough votes and put you really in you know, some heat on you by putting these back on your desk, you know, unless we don't know what. We don't know what they want to see the governor do, acquiesce entirely. I'm not sure. But that's the idea is, you know, respond with force to what the governor did.
And of course, last week, Zach, we all remember Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey was very blunt. He said the budget is done. No more negotiations. So how does today's move square with that stance?
I mean, I take, you know, anything any legislative leader says very seriously. But, you know, I think it was a little bit of a heated moment. You know, no one really expected the governor was going to veto as much as she did and as many things as she did. And I think that was probably, you know, everybody when they're upset about something is going to react maybe off the cuff a little fast. But the reality is the budget is never done. Even had none of this happened, there's always supplemental appropriations bills. The budget's always being tweaked here, tweaked there, sometimes in big ways, sometimes in small ways. And so, you know, the idea that the budget was done, you know, I didn't really see that as anything other than just, you know, tough rhetoric in a tough moment.
And of course, the governor is slated to meet with the quadrant, the top four legislative leaders from both parties on Thursday. So depending on how that goes, what might we look for from that meeting? What could it tell us?
Well, you know, the last quadrant meeting they had, they apparently barely talked about the budget. They mostly talked about policy bills. I think what to watch for is to what extent are lines being drawn in the sand again and threats being made. You know, look, each side has ample weapons to make life very difficult on the other. You know, the Republicans could force veto override votes that would put Democrats in a jam. They could hold votes on all these things and put everything back on the governor's desk. The governor could veto everything again. The governor could, you know, decide, and I'm just spitballing here. This is nothing anybody's
sure.
actually said. The governor could decide, you know what, I'm tired of your antics. I'm not signing any other bills you send to me until we fix this budget. You know, that's always a weapon in the governor's arsenal. The Senate could decide, and again, I'm just spitballing here, okay, you're going to do that. We're going to start rejecting your appointees to boards and commissions. So, you know, this could get a lot worse if everybody decides to dig in and not sort of extract themselves and find a way out of this. And I don't know really how it's going to go at this point. It's still too new.
Quite a poker game you're describing.
Yes. Yes, there's definitely a lot of bluffing going on.
Zach Gorchow from Gongwer News Service, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The land beneath the railroad tracks along the Pere Marquette River in Baldwin is washing. It's eroding into the river. Locals are concerned about a derailment, but the company that owns the railroad tracks said that won't happen anytime soon. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner has more.
On a warm early fall day, Park Smith walks alongside the curvy path of the Pere Marquette River. The fly fisherman says he admires the river, which is spring-fed and cold enough to support brown trout.
This is where brown trout, German brown trout, taken from Baron von Baer's farm in Basel, Switzerland, came to America.
Smith is a member of the Flint Rainbow Club, a private fishing club operating since 1916. He and the other members of the club worry the prized trout are in danger of chemicals spilling into the river from train cars. For years, the river has slowly cut into the steep land beneath an active railway. Trees once dotting the higher parts of the sandy bank have caved into the water.
And as you can see, that tree is almost literally in midair. The soil underneath it is eroded. You can see the roots hanging out. This one over here has fallen in. There's another one gone now that was over there. It fell in about 2 years ago.
Smith says erosion is tricky. It happens slowly over many decades. But with an intense water event like prolonged rain or ice, pieces of land can crumble without warning.
If this settles and becomes uneven, the cars fall over. This will be the low side, and you can see that's just straight downhill there in the river. You either have a slick of this asphalt paste or you poison the river with the chemicals.
Smith has watched train cars roll by with the car's contents written on them. Asphalt, road salt, magnesium hydroxide slurry. Mark Tonello, a fisheries biologist for the Michigan DNR, says if the train's contents were to end up in the water, it would devastate the river's ecology.
You know, you can create a biological oxygen demand where you suck all the oxygen out of the water and it kills fish that way. There's a number of different things that can happen.
He adds it would be a tough blow to the local economy, which relies on the river recreation tourism.
If a train were to go in that river, it would be a really big deal, and it would make national news, and it would be a big black eye to everyone involved.
On the opposite side of the river is Jim Boss's home. He is the president of the Pierre Marquette Watershed Council and has been working on the erosion problem for a decade. Twice a day, he feels the earth rumble around his house several hundred feet from the train, pulling about 50 cars. Boss says the rail company maintains the tracks well.
But they inspect it from up there, and I'll challenge you to tell if you can see where the water hits the soil from up there. You can't see it. It's too vertical.
He says they don't see how fragile the land is beneath. Genesee in Wyoming, a Connecticut-based company, currently owns the train tracks and says the erosion is not happening on their property, so it's not their responsibility. But the company says it monitors the location closely and would take action long before any unsafe conditions develop. Boss disagrees and says the situation is already urgent because of high water levels.
We've seen, you know, with the climate change and everything else, there's bigger storms. When we get rain, it's not a quarter inch anymore. It's an inch and a quarter. And, so there's going to be more wear and tear on this bank, I think, going forward.
In June, Michigan Senator Kurt Vanderwall arranged a meeting between the local group and the railroad company. And during it, the company agreed to let the Watershed Council build up the bank with gravel to better secure the railroad tracks. They're also going to plant trees and bushes to root the foundation. But just as the effort finally moves forward, the council is losing some steam. Boss says the engineering designs have cost $73,000, and the construction itself will cost several hundred thousand dollars the council doesn't have. Add on the special permits that take time to get and grant applications, it will likely be another 2 years before construction can begin. For Stateside, I'm Taylor Wisner.
That story was featured on Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. You can find more episodes at pointsnorthradio.org. Coming up, a recent op-ed in the Detroit Free Press from two former UAW officials calls out corruption in the union. We'll hear from one of the authors of that op-ed after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The UAW strike against General Motors is now in its 23rd day. As 48,000 workers continue walking picket lines around the country, the cloud of the ongoing federal corruption probe is hanging over the bargaining table. An investigation that began with the union's FCA department and resulted in convictions has widened and expanded to alleged corrupt conduct by three former and two current UAW leaders, including lavish spending of union funds. Striking workers like GM Flint Truck Assembly workers Sean Crawford, living on their $250 a week strike pay, are watching.
I think it's a disgusting shame, and they really do a disservice to the memory of the people who fought and died for this union to make it what it is. And anyone who's out there who is corrupt, you know, they need to be found out. They need to be taken out by the root.
Well, Frank Joyce agrees with that statement and then some. He is the former director of public relations for the UAW from 1990 to 2002. Together with the Reverend Peter Larman, another former head of the union's public relations department, they published an op-ed last Friday in the Detroit Free Press entitled, "Amid Corruption Allegations, the UAW Needs a Fresh Start." Frank Joyce is here with me now. Frank, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You call this not a public relations problem, but a slow motion catastrophe that engulfs the union. Why did you feel the need to speak out?
Because no one else had, is the short and simple answer. Both Peter and I come from an era of the UAW, as I've been a member of many locals, and I was on the staff for quite a time. I'm still a UAW member. And one of the things that has distinguished the UAW historically is a capacity for self-policing. It's not that there have never been scandals. It's a human institution, so they happen.
But what we were having trouble understanding is that revelation after revelation after revelation was coming out, and there was nothing but silence from Solidarity House, from other former staff people and members and so on. And we just felt it was time to, pardon the expression, break the silence.
And in your op-ed, you say all the members of the union's international executive board should resign, and you said any of the senior staff that are assisting current officers and board members who are playing that see no evil, hear no evil enabling should also resign. It's a strong call. What kind of reaction have you gotten since you published the piece Friday?
Well, I would say that most of the reaction has been positive. We anticipated that there would be opposition and pushback, and there has, of course, been some of that, too. And that's okay. Part of our whole objective here is we need to be able to have an open and transparent discussion. The UAW is clearly in a crisis. We haven't even heard the last of whether there will be further indictments, whether there will be further raids, further investigations. But what is coming out loud and clear is that the UAW isn't apparently dealing with this itself. One of our concerns, as you know, Cynthia, there's been speculation that, well, maybe this winds up with the U.S. government taking over the running of the union for 10 or 15 or 20 years, as happened with the Teamsters Union. We think that would be devastating to the UAW membership. Well, it's very hard to forestall a government takeover if you're not promoting an alternative plan of reform.
In your op-ed, you and your co-author, Reverend Peter Larman, argue that the UAW has completely lost its way in respect to mission and purpose. Tell us more. In what ways?
Well, I think two things come immediately to mind in that. One is this code of silence. We know that there are board members who are not supportive of this corruption and who presumably are not involved with it. But they have a degree of complicity by virtue of their silence. And that's why we are saying the closer we can get to a clean sheet of paper here, the closer we can get to empowering the membership and creating an environment that's transparent and that's open. We don't think, by the way, that corruption is the only problem facing the UAW. All unions in the United States are facing very difficult circumstances, and our concern in part is that the corruption is a distraction from the deeper discussion that needs to take place in the UAW and other unions as well.
Take us back. Let's harken back to the years when you headed the UAW's Public Relations Department, Frank, from 1990 to 2002. How were things different then?
Well, I have to say, when I look back now, I think I can see some of the beginnings of this problem that were taking place when I was there, and I suppose I was myself complicit at that point in not speaking out more. We used to have a joke that you may recall and appreciate in the PR department, which was, we called ourselves the Department of No Comment. So I make that point to say it's not as though this culture of silence goes way back in the UAW, including to the time that I was on the PR department staff and was the PR department director. It's easy to say now in hindsight, well, if more had been done then, we wouldn't be in the extent of the problem we are now. And that's true. It's not an argument, though, for not speaking out now. One of the things that we refer to in the piece is that between General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler is a whole infrastructure of what are called joint programs. They have separate buildings, they have overlapping and separate staffs, they have large budgets, and within those programs, we think, is an example of how the union lost its way in its inability to monitor those programs and some of the early revelations about scandalous spending came out of those programs. And that's why we also call for a suspension of those programs until they can at least be reviewed as to their purpose and as to their governor.
What other steps do you want to see the union take? They've already placed Vance Pearson, a powerful UAW director, on leave, but what other steps should the union take?
Well, we wish we knew more than we do about what else is still being investigated. But we also think that the UAW needs to take control of its own destiny. Why isn't it conducting its own internal investigation? Why was it so slow to tell Vance Pearson that he had to take a leave of absence? Certainly, he's a distraction, and certainly he's distracted. If he's concerned about his own indictment, this has to stop, and there has to be the ability to focus on the health and the integrity of the union, as I said a minute ago, as a means to be more effective at taking on the huge corporations that dominate the economy.
Frank, as we've talked about, the UAW is on strike right now. That's the short-term issue. In the long-term, as you alluded to, there's this concerted effort to weaken unions in this country for a variety of reasons. We're not going to get into those here. But how critical is it for the UAW and the union movement in America more broadly that these reforms that you call for are successful?
Well, I think it's very important. I think working people have never needed unions more than they need them now. If you look, for example, at all the measures of inequality that are far greater now than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and 30 years ago, that's directly related to the shift in power in favor of employers and in favor of capital and against working people, whether they're unionized or not. And by the way, I want to be clear that we don't think that fighting corruption or supporting the fight with GM is an either-or proposition. Quite the contrary. We think the more that unions are corruption-free, open and transparent, the stronger they are to take on corporations like General Motors, who are experiencing record profits and, as always, resisting sharing those with workers, especially temporary workers. And so we see these issues as very closely connected.
Well, a powerful editorial by Frank Joyce and his co-author, the Reverend Peter Larman. You'll find it in the Detroit Free Press. Frank Joyce, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Halloween decorations are popping up everywhere. It's time to think of things spooky, and that includes a theater in Ypsilanti. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here with a look at theater all around the state. So, David, what is this play that is completely in the spirit of Halloween?
Yeah, it's being produced, as you say, in Ypsilanti, in the Ypsilanti Experimental Space on Washington Street. It's a new work by playwright Joe Zettelmeyer. It's called Haunted, the Michigan Ghost Story Project. And it's terrific. In fact, Joe Zettelmeyer kind of puts himself into the play, almost like Stephen King has done sometimes, where the main character is the author. And so the author in the story is a guy who's doing this Michigan Ghost Story Project. And so the play itself is vignettes about some of the ghost stories that he has collected. And some of them are, you know, take place in the UP. Some of them take place in Detroit. One takes place in Ypsilanti. And we got a chance to talk to Joe this week about, you know, kind of what started him on this project and where it took him.
So the show itself is a collection of ghost stories that I gathered from both my own research, and then I opened it up to submissions from people all over, as long as the ghost story happened in Michigan. And I got many, 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 many submissions. We've got everything from a ghost story that happens in the Bonstell Theater over at Wayne State to, yeah, some pretty creepy stuff that happened in an old abandoned mansion in the Upper Peninsula.
This is perfect for Halloween.
Isn't it, though? And I want to say something about the space. First of all, the play, the show itself is directed by Anna Simmons. She does a terrific job. The Yes Space, Ypsilanti Experimental Space, very intimate. Only about 25 people or so can fit in at once. And I want to say, without giving away a spoiler, that you're in downtown Ypsilanti, and to me, one of the most interesting ghost stories literally took place blocks away from the theater.
Very fun. So you get spooky history. It's ideal. So that's at the Ypsilanti Experimental Space. And now from this new work by Joe Zettelmeyer, we go to a true American musical classic on stage in Kalamazoo.
Right. The Farmer's Alley in Kalamazoo is doing Camelot.
A law was made a distant moon ago here. July and August cannot be too hot. And there's a legal limit to the snow here in Camelot.
This, of course, the King Arthur Knights of the Round Table story that's given us some Broadway classic tunes from Lerner and Lowe, like the title tune Camelot, songs like If Ever I Would Leave You, The Lusty Month of May, What Do the Simple Folk Do? But I want to say this is actually a bit of a modern take. This is a play that I've seen a few times done in regional theater. It can be very dusty. They really pumped some new, fresh life into it. It's a smaller cast. They kind of rearranged a few things. This is a play that actually the director has a lot of freedom in how to stage it. And the Farmer's Alley folks took all of that freedom to kind of give you a fresh look at this very old classic play.
I am so intrigued, and yet we get the great songs
exactly.
along with that.
Yeah, terrific.
Fantastic. Okay, and now we go to Rochester Hills to the Meadowbrook Theater doing one of your favorite stories.
It absolutely is. My first exposure to Murder on the Orient Express was my dad took me to see it at Radio City when I was about 11, I guess, 12. And I absolutely, even though I was a kid, and it's kind of a grown-up movie, I loved it. This is a yarn about a murder. It's an Agatha Christie that takes place on the legendary Transcontinental Rail Line. So in addition to the movie, of course, on PBS, and people are familiar with Hercule Poirot, the Belgian detective. He's aboard the train, and he's drafted by the railway owner to solve the murder of an American businessman. And Poirot is very ably played by Michigan actor Ron Williams. So even though you know how it turns out, there's no surprises, it's a terrific production. And as always, the Meadowbrook does an amazing job with set and props. So, I mean, they don't cheap out on anything. So it's really a terrific production of this.
So much like their Christmas Carol.
Exactly.
I mean, we know the story, but they do it so splendidly.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, now it is time to come to the cabaret because the Kit Kat Club is open for business in Walled Lake.
That's right, at the New Jet Theater.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum.
Very familiar musical to most of us, I think, set in Germany in the 1930s, as Hitler's coming to power. The cast for this play, it opens this weekend. The cast for this play looked very intriguing to me. Terrific actors. And let's face it, you can't not love the songs from the show. You know, Maybe This Time, Money, Money, If You Could See Her, Mein Herr, and of course the title song. It's if you don't leave the theater humming, you know, one song or another, there's something wrong with it. So when done right, the show is terrific. I'm very intrigued by the cast, so I'll be seeing it this weekend.
And speaking of coming away from a show humming, a real crowd pleaser is coming up at the Barn Theater in Augusta.
Yeah, exactly. Again, for you know, just in time for Halloween. Usually a summer theater, but the Barn is doing the Rocky Horror Picture Show, opening October 18th.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll.
Feel free to dress up as your favorite character, Cynthia.
There you go.
And anybody who wants to do the time warp again, the Barn is going to give you the chance the second half of the month.
So much fun. And we should note, if you weren't able to see Come From Away in East Lansing, it is at the Fisher Theater until Sunday the 13th. I finally got to see it, and boy, that crowd reaction was amazing. It's so good. Actually, I'm going back again this week.
it makes you feel so good. You know, there's so much right now in the world and in the news to make us feel bummed out. This takes us back to a time when the country, and actually this takes place in Newfoundland, so technically Canadians, but our neighbors to the north, but it makes us remember what we should be about in terms of, you know, when tragedy hits. It takes place on the week of 9/11, when the country and so much of the world was pulling the oars in the same direction. It's a wonderful show. It's so tight. You know, for people who don't want to go to a long musical that might last 3 hours, this is like an hour 45 with no intermission. It snaps along, and it makes you feel so good.
Oh, the crowd was on its feet. It is. It's a powerful evening of theater, again, till the 13th of October. Well, as always, you can get details on these and all kinds of productions around Michigan. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, what is direct primary care and how could it change the way many of us visit our doctor? We'll talk about it after the break, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There was a time in this country when someone who needed medical care would take themselves to the doctor's office, or the doctor might make a house call. Care was provided, the doctor was paid, and everything that transpired was between patient and physician. No insurance companies, no co-pays, no filing claims. Well, some physicians are turning back the clock, so to speak, offering direct primary care subscription-based. In Grand Rapids, Dr. Matt Falkowitz and Nicholas Blank are doing that through their Nova Direct Primary Care. So let's talk about direct primary care as we say hello to Dr. Matt Falkowitz. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
So, doctor, what are the basic differences between direct primary care and that traditional primary care that most people are used to?
Probably the biggest difference up front is that we don't bill any insurance. One of the big hallmarks of direct primary care is a membership-based model. So you pay a set monthly fee, but then you kind of get essentially almost unlimited access to your primary care physician. So you can text us, call us, video chat, home visits, you know, in-office visits, all of that is included in that membership, and you don't have to pay a specific copay each time you see us.
And then if certain tests are ordered or x-rays or treatments, that would be something that you would pay for on top?
Yeah. So most direct primary care practices have other resources around their office that they can offer x-ray, they can offer lab work, those sort of things we get at decreased rates because people are paying cash for it. You know, going through insurance and those other sort of avenues, prices tend to get inflated. So just to give you an example, if you need to check what we call a basic metabolic profile, which checks things like sodium, potassium, your kidney function, those sort of things. If you go through a hospital system or an insurance-based system, that can easily cost you $40 to $100 on an outpatient basis, but through us, it's $2.50. So those excessive kind of costs are really what we're trying to avoid with direct primary care.
And just give us an idea what it costs for that monthly fee, that subscription.
So our subscription is, we do it age-based. So for the pediatric population or age 0 to 17, we do $29 a month. For 18 to 49, we do $59 a month. And then for 50 and over, we do $79 a month. If you sign up as a couple or as a family, we do end up offering a discount with that as well.
What made you and your partner, Dr. Blank, decide that direct primary care was the best way for you to serve patients?
How much time do we have? A few things. So Nick and I actually trained together in residency, and we initially started kind of wanting to do an insurance-based practice. And then once we kind of came across electronic health record that was built specifically for direct primary care practices, we kind of went down that avenue. But really the biggest difference we see is that we can spend more time with patients, and we are very patient-centered when it comes to our primary care, and we just want to sit down and get to know you. So when we were working in residency, and even after residency, working in a rural community in an insurance-based system, we're often running 20, 30 minutes behind. The biggest reason for that is we just want to sit and get to know you, get to know your story, and try to talk about all the different concerns that you may have. In insurance-based practice, it doesn't really work out very well because you only get, you know, 15 to 20 minutes per visit. Direct primary care, we're able to sit, spend an hour with you, get to know you a lot better, talk about all the concerns that you have, talk about all the things that we may want to address with you, and we have enough time to get those things done.
You know, as you mentioned, that that timetable that a doctor in an insurance-based practice gets a certain set period of time to spend with the patient, and then you should move on. What does the public not understand, doctor, about what it's like to practice medicine in that kind of insurance-based model?
There's a lot of checkboxes that we have to click in each visit. There's a lot of studies out there as far as how much time doctors are spending really on the administrative tasks, pleasing insurance companies, those sort of metrics that we're doing that may not be related directly to patient care. And it's roughly about 2/3 of our time. So if you have a 20-minute time slot, that also accounts for the time that, you know, the nurse checks you in, they're doing all your vitals, they're taking your history, doing that sort of thing. By the time we get into the room, it may already be 7 to 10 minutes into your visit. So really at that point, we may only have 10 minutes to see you. You know, if you have two specific concerns on top of what you came in to be seen for, say high blood pressure, diabetes, something like that, it becomes very difficult to try to address each problem in a 2-minute time span. And then we're sitting here trying to fill out, you know, your history, trying to type in a physical exam, trying to come up with a plan and type everything in the computer. Oftentimes we're facing away from the patient. You feel like it's a very impersonal space, when really it should be a very personal space, the relationship with you and your doctor.
What kind of patients does direct primary care work best for, and what does the model not work well for?
I talk with Nick about this all the time. There's probably four subsets of patients that work really well in the direct primary care system, at least for our practice specifically. One is patients who are uninsured. That can be for any number of reasons, whether they're, you know, self-employed or they make a little too much for Medicaid but can't afford the marketplace. People who have cost-sharing ministries or health-sharing ministries. People who have high deductible plans, so the, you know, anything over $2,000. And then also people who aren't happy with their current healthcare experience. You know, we're something new or something different, and we can offer you the access. If you are really happy with your current situation, you're happy with the doctor you have, you're happy with the insurance you have, there's probably going to be no reason for you to switch to us just because we're not going to be able to beat that. You know, there's not a huge population, I would say, that wouldn't fit well with the direct primary care system. But if you're happy with what you have, chances are we're not going to be able to make that any better.
Data showing that the number of DPC practices and doctors considering opening a DPC practice is going up. Do you think direct primary care could or should overtake insurance-based treatment?
So it is growing quite rapidly. So I would say, you know, a couple of years ago, there were maybe only 400 to 500 practices nationwide. And as of July 2019, there were over 1,200, with a rate of growing maybe 1 to 2 every week at this point. That's more of a symptom of the system. Doctors are getting, you know, burned out. There's a lot of moral injury happening within the system. So people are trying to get out and try to provide better care and have more control over their health care. Do I think direct primary care should take over the entire insurance system? I wouldn't phrase it like that, just because I think some sort of insurance is still necessary. As a DPC physician and being a family medicine doctor, I can't handle things that are emergencies like heart attacks. You know, I can't provide surgical services if you need your gallbladder or appendix out. So you're always going to need some sort of coverage, whether it's a catastrophic coverage, a high deductible plan, or a health sharing ministry, like I mentioned before. But I think from a primary care standpoint, you know, primary care is very well known to decrease costs in the health system overall. So the more primary care doctors we have out there that are able to spend more time with patients, do things very efficiently and effectively, I think we can decrease costs significantly and help the population in general.
How does direct primary care compare to clinics? For example, that you could do a walk-in and pay a small fee. People who don't have insurance may turn to that kind of maybe a walk-in clinic.
The biggest difference, I think, with direct primary care and kind of an urgent care or a med center or you know, a walk-in clinic would be really the relationship with your doctor. So if you go to an urgent care or walk-in clinic, you're going to be seeing someone different every time that has a very, very brief amount of time to try to get to know you, review your chart, and just see what the chief complaint is. You know, from a primary care office perspective versus an urgent care or walk-in clinic, you're much more likely to get something like an antibiotic for a common cold or something like that, rather than if you had a trusting physician relationship with a direct primary care practice. I think one of the biggest fears in the healthcare system is really cost. You know, so if you go into an urgent care clinic, you may pay a $75, $50 copay. You want something done at that visit just because you don't want to have to pay to go back. In the direct primary care practice, you know, if you're paying the set monthly fee, you can see us as often as you need without fear of cost, without fear of paying another time for the second visit, even if it's only 3 to 4 days later. So that's really the biggest difference. You have that personal relationship and you know who you're going to talk to every single time.
Dr. Falkowitz, do you think concerned that DPC practices will create more healthcare inequality? Is there validity to that concern? You know, there are those who can afford it and those who can't.
So direct primary care, we try to do our best to keep the prices as affordable as possible. Now, if we think about, you know, $50 a month is half the cost of a phone bill, or, you know, if you get coffee every single day, if you cut your coffee so every other day at Starbucks or Big B, you can afford our membership. I don't think it necessarily will create inequality. I think moving forward, if we push direct primary care, you know, try to find, you know, innovative ways to get our name out there as far as, you know, other payers and things, maybe even considering paying for the membership just because we decrease costs overall. So from an inequality standpoint, you know, most of our patients are uninsured. Most of our patients, about 90% of our patients are either uninsured or have a high deductible health plan. So those are, you know, tend to be the population that we're looking at as far as being with the inequalities.
What do you think the answer is? I know you're in the Grand Rapids area. You know, you've got a city where nearly a quarter of the people there are under the poverty level. You know, as someone who provides that direct care, that primary care, what's the answer for those people?
You know, direct primary care, we try to look, you know, at our pricing and whatnot. So if someone is under the poverty level, if they're on Medicaid, you know, we may not be the best solution for them. If they're having concerns, if they can't get in to see a doctor, if they're in the urgent care or ER every other week, you know, it may be worthwhile from a time perspective for someone to pay for the membership. Now, there are certain patients that we do kind of what we call a DPC scholarship for. If they're going through a hard time, if they sign up and a couple months in they're saying, hey, I'm just having trouble, you know, affording the membership, it's not working out well for me, we can either try to work with them a little bit and try to increase the value of the membership or see what we can do moving forward. But you know, DPC, essentially, we're healthcare. We're doing the best we can as from a healthcare perspective, but, you know, we are a business as well. So if mm-hmm. we, you know, have free care for half of our patients, then the clinic will close. That's kind of just the reality of it, unfortunately.
What would it take to get you to willingly go back to an insurance-based practice?
Oh, goodness. Nova would just have to not work out at all. Currently, we're doing fine, trying to make things work. But it would be, Nova would just absolutely have to be just completely blown up.
I gotcha. Dr. Matt Falkowitz, who's co-owner of the Direct Primary Care Office, Nova Direct Care in Grand Rapids. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
We turn now to Mary Ann Udall Phillips, who's director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. Mary Ann, just how prevalent is this direct primary concept in Michigan?
Well, it's pretty small in Michigan. It's pretty small in the country. There's a service that actually keeps count of how many physicians participate in direct primary care. And nationwide, just a little more than 1,000 physicians say that they are direct primary care. Very, very small.
Would we say, what's the trend? Is it flat? Is it growing?
It's growing a little bit. Mm-hmm. We did a survey at our center that looked at how many physicians in Michigan say they are participating in direct primary care. And about 4% of primary care physicians say they are. But about 20%, a little more than 20% said they're thinking about it, they're interested in it. So I think it's a trend primary care physicians are watching.
So thinking of the traditional insurance-based medical practice that people are very familiar with, how much of a viable alternative is DPC?
Right. So people need to know that this is not insurance, right? This is a direct payment. That's kind of the word, direct primary care, a direct payment between a consumer and a primary care physician. And in return, that primary care physician doesn't bill insurance for most services and basically says they will take care of the patient. They'll be available, you know, in some cases, 24 hours. They have smaller practices, so they do things directly with the patient.
Spending more time with the patient is one of the things we heard from Dr. Matt Falkowitz that he liked, that he wasn't on that tight timetable that they are under, in his view, when they're in the insurance model.
Yeah, so physicians who are doing direct primary care have much smaller caseloads, and they are not doing every 15 minutes a new patient. That's their focus.
So when you say it's not insurance, then what are the pitfalls for consumers there?
Well, there isn't consumer protection, and so people need to know that the insurance, the rules that govern insurance don't apply to these relationships. They're, you know, again, they're sort of direct between the patient and the physician. And the patient usually will still have to buy insurance because this only covers a limited set of primary care services, right? So, you know, if you need surgery or you need most medications, you would still need to either pay for that out of pocket or pay for insurance. So insurance would be on top of the kinds of services provided by your primary care physician.
So that's what you see as some of the drawbacks.
Yes.
What do you think are some of the pluses?
Well, the pluses are that you're not being rushed in and rushed out. Depending on the model, there are some models where you can get, you know, more enhanced services, executive physicals and things like that, depending on what you're paying for that. Sometimes physicians will say they're available to you 24 hours a day, so you have more access, you can get in immediately, so it's more accessible to the patient.
So who do you think this is not suited for? Who is DPC not suited for?
Well, certainly you have to have money in order to be able to do this. You know, they generally charge at least $50 a month for these kinds of services, and sometimes they're up to $200 or more, depending on the nature of the services. So people who don't have a lot of extra disposable income are not likely to be able to afford these kinds of services.
As you say that there are doctors in the survey who are thinking of this, who are
yes.
open to this idea, what does this interest and this kind of uptick in DPC practices say to you?
Well, it says to me that many primary care physicians feel frustrated with the current structure that they're living under, that they feel pressed to see a lot of patients in a short period of time, that they don't feel like they can build those personal relationships that you might think back to the old days when primary care was seen as a very personal relationship. And so I think they like the concept. I do think they worry about, many of them worry about the income inequality disparities that it might reinforce because, again, people are paying for this out of pocket. And I think there are many physicians who have concerns about that idea. But I think they'd like to get back to a day when they had a real relationship with patients.
And that concern you talk about, we hear that concierge care, boutique
yes.
medicine, those
yes.
terms are used. Is,
yes.
is there a work through around that, do you think?
For people in poverty or people who are very low income, is there a way to address this? There have been proposals. You know, the state of Michigan passed in 2015 a piece of legislation to test this idea within Medicaid that was designed to try to do something for people who are lower income. That pilot really hasn't gone anywhere because it's, again, it's more expensive for the state. It makes it very difficult. You know, we're balancing the cost of healthcare and trying to keep healthcare affordable with the desires to have more broader access to care. So it's a challenge. I haven't seen a very good workable model on that yet.
So what should patients consider when they are looking at the landscape and deciding which model of healthcare delivery is best for them?
Right. So, you know, they really should consider what are their needs. You know, do they really need 24-hour access to a primary care physician? Is that something that's meaningful to them? You know, if you're generally healthy, maybe you don't need a model that's like this. If you really do want that immediate access and, you know, your time is limited and you have disposable income and you have a relationship with a physician who is in a model like this, you know, that might be something for you to consider. But you've got to balance it with all the other needs you have as a family, as an individual. Again, you're going to have to buy insurance in addition to this, and you're going to have to think about the fact that you're going to have, in some cases, double coverage, and this direct primary care won't have those consumer protections in it.
So where do you see, if you look out into the kind of the landscape of the future with healthcare delivery, where do you see direct primary care fitting in?
Oh, it's a really interesting question. You know, I think the whole question is a broader question. Where do we see primary care fitting in? One thing that we know in the U.S. versus other countries, we pay less for primary care, and we have fewer primary care physicians, and the demands on primary care are going up as medicine gets more complex, as primary care physicians need to know more. And so I think we have to really be thinking about how do we support primary care physicians going forward. Direct primary care is one model. Some ideas around that have been surfaced, but there are other models that are being tested right now. So we have what's known as patient-centered medical homes that are where actually health plans, insurers give more money to primary care physicians to really do coordination of care. And I think those models have a lot of promise for the future. Accountable care organizations often put primary care physicians in a more central role and provide them with incentives and bonuses if they take on some extra responsibilities. So I think the whole question is, how do we better support primary care so we have viable numbers of primary care physicians for the future?
Marianne Udall-Phillips directs the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. It is always great talking with you. Thank you.
And you too, Cindy. All right. Take care.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.